I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. For centuries now, one of, if not the greatest source of tension between Christians and Jews, has been the struggle to determine the role of Jews in the arrest, trial, and execution of Jesus Christ. This story, first told in the Gospels, has since been performed year after year in something called the Passion Play. Through time, Passion Play sparked regular incidents of anti-Semitic backlash as Christians reacted to a theatrical depiction of angry Jews calling for the blood of Christ. In recent years, some Christian leaders and scholars of the historical Jesus have tried to revise the stereotypes of the Passion Play, urging a more reconciliatory presentation. Enter Mel Gibson, film star and director of such violent action films as Braveheart and Lethal Weapon. Gibson's also known as an archly conservative Catholic, ready to release his own version of the Passion Play in a widescreen feature-length film. And so the debate begins again. This hour, we're going to talk about the history of the Passion Play, and will there ever be any agreement over who's responsible for the death of Christ? We'd like to have you join our conversation. Should there be an agreement over who's responsible for the death of Christ? Do you believe reenactments of Jesus' death will always incite anti-Semitic sentiments? Beyond the controversy over the Gibson film, why is it that the centuries-old story of the Passion summons up such strong feelings? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us on the program today, James Shapiro. He is a professor of English literature at Columbia University and author of Oberammergau, The Troubling Story of the World's Most Famous Passion Play. James, it's nice to have you with us.
A pleasure to be on with you.
And joining me here in the studio in Boston, Philip Cunningham. He is adjunct professor of theology and executive director for the Center for Christian Jewish Learning at Boston College. Philip, it's nice to have you
here. Good morning. Thank you.
Can I ask you, Philip, to begin with what may seem like a horribly simple question, but it's how do we really know the truth of anything that happened 2,000 years ago? Where do we go for that?
Well, our primary sources of information, of course, are the four canonical Gospels in the Christian New Testament. We have some supplemental information that is available from Roman and Jewish writers of around the same century. But really, in terms of details, it has to be the four canonical Gospels.
The four canonical being
Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Okay.
Now, having said that, however, it's important to stress, and I say this particularly from my own Catholic perspective, that the Gospels are not historical documents in the way that we define history today. They are theologically driven narratives. They are stories about Jesus, with their roots certainly in the memories of Jesus' life and death from around the year 29, 30, 31. But they are written not so much to impart historical data about Jesus as they are to promote faith in him as the one crucified and raised to transcendent life.
Okay, but already we're into an area where there's disagreement because evangelical and fundamentalist Christians would say, no, they are the truth. That is the history. That's the Word of God, right?
I think that there is a divide within Christianity between those who take a sort of literalist understanding of the scriptures as free from error in historical details, and those Christians who understand that the scriptures are inspired in terms of their theological content and not necessarily in terms of their historical information.
James Shapiro, tell me a little bit about the origin of the Passion Play. Did they start with it in the years after Christ's death, or did it come much later?
There weren't Passion Plays in Europe or anywhere in the world about the crucifixion, the suffering of Jesus, for 1,100 years after Jesus lived and died. It began in the 12th century in Europe, first in Latin and then in the vernacular languages, and flourished for about 500 years, under various kinds of political and religious pressures, declined. And what we're seeing now with Mel Gibson's film to be released on Ash Wednesday is a revival, if you will. There have been periodic revivals in film, and there are Passion Plays like the Oberammergau Passion Play and others. But this is a belated form. Nobody had the idea in hundreds of years after Jesus lived to dramatically
enact it. So what brought them about? Why 1,200 years after the death of Christ did people start presenting it as a play, as a piece of theater?
Scholars struggle to figure out answers to that. One is that there wasn't much theater, certainly in Europe, between Roman and early Christian medieval times. But there's also a need to dramatize. And here we get into more speculative realms. Why does Mel Gibson need to make this film? Why do people need to see it now? Is it a matter of shaky faith? Is it a matter of revival? Certain kinds of ways of thinking about Jesus. One of the things that's really important to understand is there was a sea change in how Jesus was perceived and worshipped around this time, 12th century, 13th century, moving from Jesus as king to a man of sorrows and a tremendous focus on the passion and suffering, his final hours. And the passion play, like a lot of great art and music and literature that emerged at this time, came out of this desire to really understand and visualize the passion and suffering of Jesus.
Important, I think, to point out here, Philip, that passion actually comes from the Latin passio, for suffering. Mm-hmm. It's not a play that necessarily uses the word passion the way it's used in vernacular today.
No, or in soap operas in particular, yes.
What's the timeline here? The passion play begins at what point in Christ's life and takes us to what point in his death or resurrection?
The typical understanding of what delineates the passion narratives in the Gospels breaks that down into five scenes. The first scene being the arrest of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane at nighttime. The second scene being Jesus' encounter with the temple priest's leadership. The third scene being Jesus' encounter with Pontius Pilate, the Roman prefect. The fourth scene being the actual execution or crucifixion itself. And the fifth scene, the burial.
The Last Supper, the betrayal by Judas, these aren't necessarily important parts of the
Betrayal by Judas would fall into the arrest in Gethsemane scene.
Okay.
But certainly the Last Supper scene is the, I guess you could say, the prelude to scene one or something of that sort.
And Gibson's actually narrowed that even further this time around, has he not? It made it a little bit tighter, like the last 12 hours, or is it still those same five scenes?
My understanding is that the movie opens with Jesus in Gethsemane, so I believe it pretty well coheres with what I've just described.
Okay, James, the different ways of presenting the Passion Play, maybe I should get you just to explain what the Oberammergau Passion Play is, and we use that as a starting point for trying to understand how many different ways there are of telling this story.
Sure. Even in Oberammergau, which is the longest-running, uninterrupted passion play in Europe, which goes back to the early 1600s, if not before, has changed in virtually every production. In other words, in the 18th century and before, devils were on stage. Satan figured in this. In the late 18th, early 19th century, with a rise of realism and a desire for more compact, dramatic form, the devils went, Satan went, and you needed an adversary to Jesus. So Jews began to fill that role. And by the mid-19th century, Jews were the primary adversary for Jesus. A passion play or any story about the life of Jesus can deal with his good works, his message, his passion, or his resurrection. Mel Gibson, by focusing on the suffering, on the brutal treatment that the Romans, and I haven't seen this film yet, but I expect to see the Jews implicated in this, focuses not on Jesus' message, not on his resurrection, but on the suffering he endured in his final hours. And I think that dramatic choice is very significant. And it also tells you what makes for terrific theater or movies, which is an enemy, an adversary, mm-hmm. suffering, something that we can feel very powerfully about.
If we go back, Philip, to talk about the Gospels themselves. No one Gospel tells the whole story. The Passion Play is kind of a pastiche of the different Gospels, right?
Yes, that's correct. Each of the Gospel narrates the story of Jesus' death with some commonalities, but also with many unique features that are found only in specific Gospels.
Because the blood curse, the line in Matthew, which comes up whenever you have this conversation about the Passion Play, is therefore something that you could include or leave out, right?
Certainly. And there are official documents in the Catholic community and suggestions in other Protestant churches that advise composers of Passion Plays indeed to omit verses such as that one, which historically have proven likely to cause violence against Jews.
This is the line, where is it? Is it Caiaphas or is it the...
In the Gospel of Matthew, the crowd of Jews that has assembled is demanding the release of Barabbas instead of Jesus. Pilate decides to assent to their demands. He washes his hands dramatically in front of them, saying, "I'm innocent of the blood of this righteous man." In Matthew's gospel, the crowd then exclaims, although earlier it had said that the priests had egged them on, mm-hmm. "His blood be on us and on our children." Now, that is understood by folks who study the scriptures as Matthew's way of explaining why Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70, 40 years after, roughly, the death of Jesus. And so therefore, it's sort of delimited or focused on to Matthew's interpretation of first century historical events. However, in later Christian history, this understanding or this verse from Matthew's gospel was interpreted as a divine curse upon Jews for all time and all places. And part of a Christian theology known as supersessionism, which says that Jews have been displaced as God's chosen people and replaced by the Christian church.
And Jim Shapiro, does the decision to include or exclude that one line make a substantial difference in the way that the Passion Play is seen by Jews?
The answer is no, from the perspective of a drama historian. On the other hand, I also speak as a Jew, and I prefer not to see that line in there. But I've sat through rehearsals of the Oberammergau Passion Play. I've seen Passion Plays. That is the linchpin of the 19th century tradition of Passion Plays, which demonizes the Jews. But I have to tell you, watching a crowd of 700 on stage, Jews on stage, or Christians enacting the mm-hmm. role of Jews, crying out, kill him, or Sterbe in German, or whatever language the Passion Play is done in. You don't really need those words from Matthew. The reason why these words have become the battleground between the Anti-Defamation League and Mel Gibson and his supporters is that they touch upon the decision by the Church, the Catholic Church, with Vatican II, to decide how the Passion story should be told. And that Jews should not be collectively and in perpetuity blamed for the death of Jesus. So when the line from Matthew in the King James Bible reads, "Then answered all the people and said, his blood be on us and on our children," that sounds a lot like perpetuity and collective guilt. So this is a very sensitive question. But dramatically in the theater, when people go to see Mel Gibson's film, whether it has it this line or not won't make that big a difference.
If I could add a comment there, I mean, part of the issue, as was mentioned earlier, is which scenes from the different Gospels are combined together right. in a Passion Play narrative. One element here that's very important is from the Gospel of John. John's Gospel uses the collective phrase hoi judaioi in Greek, the Jews, as it's typically rendered, although that can be debated, but nonetheless most translations do it that way. And it's the Jews who demand the death of Jesus. But additionally, in John's presentation of this scene, the scourging of Jesus, which is a very prominent part of Gibson's film, is a strategy on Pilate's part to try and get Jesus released. Only in John's gospel is Jesus whipped in order to arouse sympathy from the crowd, which of course fails. Now, if you combine that then with Matthew's blood curse following the flogging of Jesus, then you have a heightened sense of the villainy of Jewish characters.
I have to stop you there. Connection listeners, is there ever going to be any agreement over what happened to bring about the death of Christ? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a chance to talk about the Passion Play. You're certainly going to be reading and hearing a lot about it as this month moves on, because the controversial Mel Gibson film, The Passion of Christ, is due to be released in theaters and raising all the old debates about what exactly these films depicting Jesus' life and death will bring us. With me here in Boston, Philip Cunningham, adjunct professor of theology and executive director for the Center for Christian Jewish Learning at Boston College, and James Shapiro is joining us. He is professor of English literature at Columbia University, author of a book called Oberammergau, The Troubling Story of the World's Most Famous Passion Play. Jim, let me come back to you on the point that you last were speaking about. Is there any way to present a passion play that doesn't also bring with it the charges of anti-Semitism? I mean, obviously and clearly, scholars and some Christian leaders have worked at doing that. But is that a bit of a mug's game? Is that completely sanitizing an event beyond what we know about it?
For the past 30 years, really since Vatican II, Christian and Jewish theologians and scholars have been trying to work out how to arrive at that point. And I've not been part of that dialogue. I've written about that dialogue. I think what we're getting to is bedrock difference. And I think that Jews are always going to be subject to collateral damage when there are films or plays about the Passion. Part of the problem is that the Passion story is based on the Gospels, and to a greater or lesser extent, the Jews are implicated in that. And the other part of the problem is directors and movie makers are interested in good theater. Mel Gibson has to sell tickets to this. The worse he makes the Jews look, the more he's going to create a dynamic and powerful story. That's what people have discovered over the last couple of hundred years of Passion playing. I don't think you're ever going to be able to reconcile that. I think that he's going to throw back this conversation between Jewish and Christian interfaith healing and dialogue 30 years. And I think that Passion plays around the world are watching what's happening very carefully because they have not been happy with the diluting of the powerful drama by the lessening of the conflict between Christians and Jews in these plays.
Is it fair to say, though, that, Philip, that throughout history, the Passion play has been a source of anti-Semitism?
Oh, I think that that's fair to say in a general sort of a way. However, I do think that maybe more optimistically than Professor Shapiro, that it is possible to construct a Passion narrative that combines the four Gospels by selecting not necessarily the most theatrical or dramatic scenes of Jewish tension against Jesus, but other elements from the Gospels that generally have been overlooked in the construction of Passion plays, such as the statement in Mark 14:2 that Jesus needs to be arrested at night because he's so popular that a riot may break out, or the scene in Romans chapter 11 where the high priest Caiaphas utters a fear that the Romans may destroy the temple if the crowds that are following Jesus keep on going the way they're going. Those sorts of elements, which generally are not included in Passion Play scripts, would really have a different effect, I think.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Nathan's joining us. Nathan, thanks for calling.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So what do you think?
Well, actually, I had a chance to see the movie about a week and a half ago.
How did you manage that? I didn't think it was released yet.
Right. I got to a preview session in California. I have some strange connections, and I got very, very lucky. But I went into the movie with having heard the charges of anti-Semitism, so I tried to take it from a very objective standpoint. And I can tell you, after the movie was over, I'm sure nobody in there felt any hatred. I know I didn't. And the message was love. And I think we all got that after seeing the suffering. We didn't want to hate anyone after that. And I know.
So are you saying that by making this film so extraordinarily violent that Gibson has in fact taken away from people the opportunity to feel hatred after the film?
I think people that go into the movie with the hatred already inside might lash out, but I personally didn't get that out because the message I saw was love. An interesting point that we were told after the movie is that Mel Gibson, his hand is actually in the movie holding the nail that is placing the nail on Jesus's hand to show that his death was actually the fault of everyone on earth, not just Jews.
I wonder if I could ask a question. In the film, in the version, the pre-release version that you saw, toward the beginning of the film, was there a scene in which Jesus is shackled in chains and is thrown off a bridge by the Jewish arresting party that's taking him to see the priests?
Yes, that movie was in the version that I saw.
Okay, and shortly thereafter, is there a scene of Jesus before the priests where there's enough sort of violence inflicted on Jesus by Jews wearing prayer shawls that one of his eyes is pretty effectively rendered inoperative, and he's pretty injured by this encounter?
I know one of his eyes is hit. I'm not sure if it's by a Jew or a Roman, but I know we had a discussion after the movie, and blaming the Jews for the death of Jesus would be like blaming all Germans for the fault of Hitler, or all the Russians for the fault of Stalin. You know, it goes along the same reasoning. It doesn't make much sense. So an anti-Semitic argument from that perspective is just totally bogus.
Oh, I agree with you, but I guess the concern that some of us have is that there are scenes present in the film that are not found in the New Testament in which Jewish characters inflict violence on Jesus that is not supportable by any of the Gospels. And as I think you rightly said, if there are people with animosity toward Jews already who see the film, that they will have those sentiments intensified by witnessing these non-biblically supported scenes of Jewish violence against Jesus.
I should point out to our listeners that Philip Cunningham here in the studio in Boston is one of the people who actually had a chance to see a screenplay of the film from about 10, 11 months ago. And so, Philip, part of your questioning is, you know, is Nathan seeing in the film what you read, excuse me, in the script? And Jim Shapiro, just a thought from you on
sure.
Nathan's
I'm fascinated. I'm glad that Nathan left the film screening with a feeling of love. But the question I would really ask is, if you wanted to show Jesus' message of love, why focus so unrelentingly on violence against him? And the idea that Jesus died for all our sins, which the Council of Trent formulated hundreds of years ago, is great theology, but it's not good drama. And good drama requires, whether it's Braveheart or the Passion of Jesus, of Christ, it requires an enemy. And I am concerned that the demonization of Jews in this film is inevitable. And I step away from the term anti-Semitic. It's just interesting to me that Mel Gibson has to make the Jews into the enemy of Jesus, to the extent that he does. And the question that I wish were asked of him more aggressively is, what produces the need to do this? Why show a kind of beleaguered Christianity, if you will, today? Why make the Jews into the aggressors in this? And
But didn't you answer that yourself earlier, Jim, by saying that anybody who wants to tell this story who comes at it from a dramatist point of view is going to look for the sort of most extreme clash between two different, you know, enemies.
I agree. I'm really talking about something particular to our moment in time. Why, for example, you know, the history of Passion Plays was a Catholic history. Protestants in the 18th and 19th century would not go to Passion Plays. This was what was terrible about Catholicism and its spectacle and its obsession with violence. What you have in Mel Gibson's film is a collaboration between evangelical Christians and reactionary Catholics. And that's what's fascinating to me. Why do these two groups latch onto the story in such a way?
Our number's 1-800-423-8255. To Boston next. Rachel's joining us. Rachel.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I would just like to say two things. One, we don't really know, as most serious biblical scholars would admit, exactly what happened at the crucifixion, since the Gospels all date from 70 A.D. onward. Paul, who wrote earlier, never at all mentions the responsibility or the participation of the Jews in the crucifixion. So we don't know much about what happened at the crucifixion except what the Gospels tell us. But we certainly do know what has happened for 2,000 years because of the deicide charge, because of the charge that the Jews were responsible for the death of Jesus. And the second thing I want to say is that...
Rachel, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit confused here. You began by saying that because the Gospels were written sometime after...
The Gospels are not eyewitness accounts.
Right.
We understand that.
So,
however, we do understand that the way in which they are shaped and their polemical interest gives a certain burden to the Jewish participation rather than the Roman participation in the crucifixion.
So what you're saying is that the Gospels want us to believe that it's the fault of the Jews, whether that's true or not?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's exactly right.
No, that's fine. I just want to make sure it was clear. Go ahead. You were going to make...
The Jewish mode of putting people to death. It's a Roman mode of putting people to death. So that's for starters. The second thing is we do know with great clarity that this accusation against the Jews that they killed Jesus as God produced for 2,000 years a great deal of actual historical violence against Jews during the Crusades, et cetera, et cetera. That's one thing I want to say. And the second thing I want to say is that many great Catholic and Christian scholars, such as James Carroll, James Sheehan, and so forth, are much more interested in the life of Jesus than the death of Jesus. So that to take up at this moment in historical time the violent death of Jesus and to problematize that in a way in this moment in historical time seems to me utterly provocative and very unchristian.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And Philip Cunningham, the idea that the timing is about as troublesome as it could possibly be. Is that why the debate this time around? I mean, there are already in the news reports of incidents of anti-Semitism in Europe, people angry with the policy of Israel and angry with the government there and tremendous tensions. Is that a reason to say, don't do this now?
Well, let me make two comments, if I might. One is, I think that there has been so much debate surrounding this particular film production, not so much because of the rise in anti-Semitism worldwide, but because of the claims made about the film by its producers. Icon Productions has been asserting that the script was written under the inspiration of the Holy Ghost, to use their terminology, that there were miracles associated with the filming of the film in Italy last fall, and that it presents the most accurate presentation of the crucifixion of Jesus of any film previously. Now, that may indeed, in some senses, be true because of the blood that apparently is quite profuse, although there are some historical inaccuracies, such as the nails being driven through the hands instead of the wrists and this sort of a thing. But I think some people are hearing this claim for the crucifixion being most historically portrayed as encompassing everything surrounding the circumstances of Jesus' death, not simply the mechanics of crucifixion. The second comment I wanted to make in reaction directly to what the listener just said is, I think that there are some historical facts that the gospel writers presupposed their contemporary readers would know that are very relevant here. One is that we know that the high priest Caiaphas held his position as high priest only so long as Pontius Pilate was pleased with the job that he was doing. And one of his jobs, by Roman perspectives, was to keep the peace and to make sure that there wasn't a Passover riot. The second fact that we know historically, that again the Gospels have no reason to mention, is that riots during Passover in Jerusalem were not an infrequent occurrence in the first century. And the reason is not difficult to figure out. Passover celebrates freedom from foreign domination. And here we have thousands of pilgrims, Jewish pilgrims, coming from all over the empire to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover. And what do they see but the Roman imperial eagles hanging in the temple entryway? They see Roman soldiers up at the Antonia Fortress on the Temple Mount. It's hard to celebrate freedom from foreign domination when the presence of foreign occupiers is so visible. And so riots broke out fairly regularly, oftentimes with a severe number of casualties. So that presents, those two facts alone give a very different historical backdrop, even when reading the Gospels as we now have them.
But let me bring it back. Jim Shapiro.
Sure, I was just going to ask away, Dick.
My question to you is, do you see, as Philip began his comments there, do you see a large part of the conversation that people are having about this film as a reaction to an intentional marketing thing that where the producers of The Passion of Christ are actually trying to tap into some of these deep historical feelings as a way of selling tickets to a movie?
Well, I think they've done a masterful job of getting the Jewish organizations up in arms. I think they need to, in a sense, reproduce the story of this hostile Jewish community that's trying to shut them down. I think if I could put a slightly different spin on what Philip's suggesting, what's at stake here for me is history. And there are a couple of issues of history. When the Pope is reputed to have said, "It is as it was," he's giving his blessing that what people are going to be seeing in this film is what happened 2,000 years ago. It's not. It's a vision that Mel Gibson has that comes out of a 19th century way of representing this story that's inflected by visionaries who happened to have been virulently anti-Jewish, writing in the late 18th and early 19th century. He's acknowledged their influence. This is a story. And I encourage anybody interested in that story to see this film, but not to leave this film thinking this is as it was.
Just to be clear, now the Pope wasn't making a comment on the Gibson film when he said
he was making a comment on the Gibson film. It was screened for him in the Vatican, and he reputedly said, and then his aides semi-denied, that his verdict on this film was it is as it was. And that's a very dangerous thing for anybody in his position to say, especially in light of the Vatican II position on Jewish culpability in the Passion story.
I think that the this particular account of the Pope's reactions to the film have a lot of questions associated with them. First of all, it is as it was. The only five words attributed to the Pope about this film is so cryptic. It almost sounds like the Oracle of Delphi making a pronouncement. It's not typical of John Paul II's style. That's not how he normally speaks. And since it's a five-word sentence with no nouns, we don't know exactly what the it is referring to. I could understand those words to mean that it is as it was, we're seeing a medieval passion play put on film, for all I know.
Not how it's being marketed. Precisely,
and that's the problem in terms of this is one more instance of very clever marketing of the film. A similar marketing technique has been to say that anyone who criticizes the film is essentially criticizing the New Testament, which is ridiculous because the film is not simply representing the New Testament.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. After centuries, why is it, in your view, that the Passion still elicits such strong feelings today, particularly as we're seeing them swirling around the anticipated release of the Mel Gibson film? But setting aside something that most of us have not yet seen, tell me what your view is about why people get so concerned, exercised, worried about this particular issue. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. Now, James Shapiro, professor of English literature at Columbia University, and Philip Cunningham, adjunct professor of theology and head of the Center for Christian Jewish Learning at Boston College, and me all have one thing in common. None of us have seen the Mel Gibson film, The Passion of Christ, which is receiving so much hype. But we thought what we would be able to do with this hour of radio is talk a little bit about why it is that the Passion makes for such dramatic arguments, even before films like this make it to the theaters. 1-800-423-8255. To Atlanta, Georgia next, and Dustin's joining us. Hi, Dustin.
How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Good. I just wanted to bring up the point that I think you're taking kind of a compartmentalized look at The Passion, and I realize that talking about the Passion play, that is a very compartmentalized presentation. But for many people who The Passion is more than just a play or a movie, but a vital part of their faith, and in looking in more of Jesus' life and Christ's life, even his very words given in the Gospel of Luke on the cross, where, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And I think we certainly have to look at if somehow we feel like we're vindicating Christ by persecuting another people, in this case the Jews, that's totally opposite all of what he taught throughout the Gospels, which was to love was his message.
Dustin, I take it from your call that you're one of these people who sees this as something a whole lot more than just a piece of drama. You see this as an integral part of your own faith. Fair enough?
Yeah, yes.
So when it gets put into a feature-length film, and again, I mean, let's not talk about what might or might not be in the movie, but when someone says, aha, I'm a director and I have a script and a cast that, when I put it all together, will be an act of God, which is in part what Icon Productions is saying, what's your reaction to that?
Well, as a evangelical Christian, you know, part of my belief system is that I want as many people as possible to experience the love and grace of Jesus. And if that takes putting it on a big screen to make it more available to a wider audience, then I think that's a good thing. Now, I haven't seen the movie either, so I can't make a full judgment as far as how it's presented. But on the whole, I think it's good that more people would be exposed to the Passion of Christ. And another caller talked about that that Christ's death was for not just Christians, but for everyone, and to experience that passion and that love. I think that's a good thing.
And part of the concern about the film is that it may in fact, incite anti-Semitism. It may cause violence against Jews when it's shown around the world. Does that concern you?
It concerns me, but I believe that there's certainly it's reactionary, and the movie or the passion, the story, is just more an excuse than the problem. I'm not sure how to put it, but. I think there's a much deeper root problem than just people reacting to the movie. And again, if they really feel like they're vindicating Jesus, then they should certainly look at more than just the story of the Passion, but at the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes that talk about love your neighbor. That's the second greatest commandment, Jesus said.
Okay, Dustin, don't go anywhere, because I want to bring James Shapiro in here. James, I mean, what Dustin is saying is that the value of the film as an evangelical tool, in a way, outstrips whatever the downside of it might be in terms of creating anti-Semitism. How do you address that?
You know, I think of two things when I appreciated Dustin's comments, and I actually have a question for him after an observation. What this film is doing is laying bare something that many of us would rather not lay bare, and that is the difference between the Jesus of history and the Jesus of faith. When scholars, Jewish and Christian scholars, get together, they talk about the Jesus of history. And when individuals like Dustin call in, the Jesus of history and the Jesus of faith are one and the same. And I think we have to acknowledge that there is a Jesus of history and there is a Jesus of faith, and that's one of the things that's at issue here. The question that I would have for Dustin is, if he goes to this film, as I'll go to this film, and anticipates that line, forgive them, for they know not what they do, and that line is not in there. There is no expression of forgiveness, since it only appears in one gospel. Mel Gibson's under no obligation to use it, as he's under no obligation to use any individual line from any gospel. Will he feel that it is a diminished film for failing to include that line?
I absolutely would. In the Gospel of John, John says that the greatest way for people to know that you are a follower of Christ or a disciple is the love that you have for one another. And I think as Christians and evangelical Christians, we so often come off as bigots and haters of whatever is out there, and that's totally opposite of Jesus' commandments for us. And to not include that Christ wants to forgive and to somehow put guilt on a race of people, I think that would be totally opposite of the message of hope and love that is Christianity. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I would be disappointed. That wouldn't be in there. But, again, I can't make a full judgment call until I've seen it. So I can only hope.
Okay, Philip Cunningham, your thoughts on...
Yeah, I would. First of all, I'd like to express my appreciation for Dustin's comments. As a practicing Christian myself, I share much of what he has said. I would like to come at it from a question you raised, Dick, earlier, which I think is it possible or how difficult is it to translate the Gospels into the film medium? I think the Gospels are far richer because they're multi-layered texts than can be conveyed in the sort of flat, one-dimensional medium of film. For instance, the Gospels give us four different theological takes on why Jesus is important. And we don't have time to go through what each of those four are. But how does one put that on film when one is combining the Gospels together, particularly when the film is being viewed by people who tend to think that what they see is equivalent to history rather than to faith convictions being expressed narratively? The Gibson film, I think, may be particularly prone to this problem because all of the words spoken are in Aramaic or in Latin. They actually should be Greek, but... and so the veneer of a sort of historical verisimilitude is given. And so in a way, it's even further removed from the genre of what the Gospels are as sacred texts.
And so, Jim, should it not be done at all?
I think it should be done. And I think people should say, this is the crucifixion that we're watching on a screen. But they should also know that until 1200 or 1300, no one imagined the crucifixion looked like that, that there is a history to this film. It is not as it was 2,000 years ago. It is as it has been over the last 800 or 900 years, and no further back than that. But I think it's going to be very, very difficult to get more than a small proportion of the audience seeing this film to accept that the Gospels only specify that Jesus was crucified. They don't say who did it. They don't say what it looked like. And that had to be invented or elaborated upon in ensuing centuries. And that's what's lost from this conversation.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Florence, Massachusetts now. Carl's joining us. Carl, thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. Well, I would like to simply say that the release of this film is very unfortunate for the simple reason that it coincides with a resurgence of anti-Semitism and violent incidents unprecedented since the 30s and 40s.
But there was never going to be a good time then, was there, Carl?
It's deliberate.
Okay, but hang on a second. There was never going to be a good time for it.
But this is not a particularly bad time, and not only that, the release is calculated to exacerbate these feelings, and I don't think there's any doubt about that. And that's it.
Why do you make that case? Why do you say it's calculated?
Well, because otherwise a person would have to, Mel Gibson would have had to have total blinders. His ears would be closed. His ears would be closed, and his eyes completely shut to the world around him. So, and I find that the tradition that he follows from his father and all of that is also just as pernicious. And the charge of deicide is quite amply documented, and one would have to be a complete idiot not to know its subsequent effects. So that's it in a nutshell.
Carl, thanks a lot for your call. Philip Cunningham at the Center for Christian Jewish Learning. This, I suppose, has been somewhat of a preoccupying event over the past few months, the anticipation of this film?
Well, I think that there has been a lot of conversation, which may in the end in some ways prove to be useful, conversation about the nature of the Gospels and the Passion narratives and how do we understand why Jesus' death is important, why Christians would understand that. But certainly, because the marketing, as James had said earlier, has been sort of built upon causing tensions and debates between Jews and Christians primarily, although other Christians have been having concerns with the film too. I think it has certainly elevated brought to the public mind some questions that maybe haven't been considered in all of their depth and all of their ramifications.
Do you think it could go away once the film's in the theaters? Once all this sort of, gee, I wonder what he's going to include, is passed and people get a chance to see the darn thing?
I think that's impossible to predict. I think it's going to depend to some degree on what the general reaction of American society at large is to the film once it's available for more people to see than some carefully selected audiences.
And Jim Shapiro, more than just the American audience, because in these times, I mean, to ship a few crates of DVDs around the world is a piece of cake.
Well, you have to realize that there's a large part of the world that thinks the Jews were responsible for 9/11, that Jews were sent a message to leave the World Trade Centers in time not to die. Stories can be very dangerous. But I want to emphasize that I don't think this should be censored or repressed in any way. I'm not interested in having Mel Gibson change any lines. What I'm interested in seeing is, like a canary in a coal mine, what this says about the attitudes a large number of Christians may or may not have about Jews in America today. It's very important to know that, and it's very important to know if that's changing. And I think this film will reveal that in ways that we don't ordinarily see revealed in our culture.
Is there an optimistic part of you that looks at it in the way that one of our previous callers referred to, and the sort of, you know, people who go in there with a certain point of view to be affirmed may have that point of view affirmed, but conversations like this one, other people's reactions who may be going in to see it as a piece of theater rather than a piece of scripture on the screen, may have quite a different reaction.
I applaud anybody leaving a film and saying this is about love. It's just hard for me to understand, as somebody who teaches films and narratives and plays, mm-hmm. how watching Jesus's flesh being flayed, crucified, reveals a message of love in the same way that a film about the Sermon on the Mount might.
And Philip, this is in many ways, I mean, something that the Roman Catholic Church has wrestled with, from being a part of the original Passion plays and promulgating the idea that the Jews were the devils at the time. I mean, the turn is only taken in the last couple of decades, and it's still not, I mean, the ship has not really come about on this one.
Well, that again, I like James's metaphor of the canary in the birdcage, the litmus test sort of a thing. It is possible that the constant teaching of many churches that Jews cannot be held collectively responsible for the death of Jesus may indeed have inoculated some viewers against drawing anti-Semitic conclusions from seeing Jesus' flesh being torn from his body. We'll have to wait and see about that. I think Justin, who called earlier, who enter the theater with the notion that Jesus died for everyone and that mm-hmm. no single group can be blamed, may not come away with the opposite point of view after seeing this film. It's those who have hostile attitudes going in that may have them reinforced by the film that I think is a problem, as is the way that the Bible is being literalistically interpreted on film is a grave problem, I think, for Roman Catholics and for other Christians.
We'll talk about this again, no doubt. Philip Cunningham, nice to have you here in the studio.
Thank you.
Philip Cunningham is adjunct professor of theology and executive director for the Center for Christian Jewish Learning at Boston College. James Shapiro, thanks for your time.
Pleasure.
James is professor of English literature at Columbia University and author of Ober Ammergau, The Troubling Story of the World's Most Famous Passion Play. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Thank you.